You're listening to KOPN FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, music of the world, diverse talk, more than radio. It's community radio, KOPN 89.5 FM. You're listening to Orbit Radio on KOPN, and we're working hard to get the phones working. I'm trying to get my friend Kent Stedman on the air here with me. Kent, are you there?
I'm here. Howdy, Mike.
Wow, okay, we actually got you. All right.
Nice music, by the way. I love the blues.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, that was Little Wing by a cover of that old Hendrix tune by Stevie Ray Vaughan. One of my favorites, actually. Hey, great to have you here, Kent. To everybody out there listening, my guest tonight is Kent Stedman. He is the mind-brain unit behind cyberspaceorbit.com. That's www.cyberspaceorbit.com. If you're interested in following along tonight and checking out some of the things that Kent and I are going to be talking about, go to the website and check it out, and you can kind of follow along interactively as we get on with things here. But anyway, Kent is a very interesting guy. He's been a friend of mine for a number of years, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. He is a former art professor at, where was it, Kent? I think City College of San Diego. Is that where it was?
It's Fresno City College, the armpit of California.
Okay, so Fresno, California, and an art professor back there in the 70s and the 80s, and a gifted musician. He's a great artist and a writer. But he, like I said earlier, he is an investigator of things mysterious as well, just like me. And so we're gonna have a great time tonight talking about lots of different things, primarily the sun. What's going on the sun lately? Kent just told me that we had another couple of big flares today. I read, Kent, I was, before you came on the air, I went over some of the stories that we've been talking about over the last week, all those big flares that we had in the last 5 days or so, and just the unprecedented activity we've seen on the sun in the last 4 or 5 years, when we should now be reaching solar minimum. So So anyway, that's who my guest is. And Kent's going to be with us in just a minute. We're going to take another music break here and set the mood. This is something that Kent has requested personally, and it's a really cool cover of an old, was it Joni Mitchell, Kent?
Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, an old Joni Mitchell song called Woodstock, and this is the cover by a band called The Chillage People. So check it out. We'll be back in about 8 minutes with Kent Stedman from CyberspaceOrbit.com. Kent, hang on there for me, okay?
Right.
Despite massive traffic jams, drenching thunderstorms,
You still with me there, Kent?
I'm still here.
Cool. The Chillage people on KOPN. That's a great cover of that Joni Mitchell song, Woodstock. So, okay, let's get right into it here, Kent. This is the inaugural edition of Radio Orbit. So I want to tell everybody that this is the first time we've been on the air, and we're doing our best to do it without screwing up. But I am still kind of learning the ropes here with the phone system and all that, so I appreciate Kent being patient with me and also all you guys out there that are listening to us. So, all right, let's get right to it here. Hey, Kent, why don't you tell us, give my listeners a little bit of a background, where you came from. We talked a little bit about Fresno and the 70s and stuff, and give us a little bit of your background, and then we'll move up into orbit and how that whole thing got going.
Okay, well, hello, everybody out there. Let's do this first. Just to sort of link up, because I'm quite aware that there's more than just Mike and myself here. There's you folks out there. So I'm a creative type, we'll go into that. So if you'll imagine that we're all sitting around a campfire on a high peak somewhere in the mountains, and then telling some tales. That's how I'm going to regard this next this conversation as we go. And by the way, we're going to be talking about the Sun right off the bat, because the Sun just kicked up a huge M8 flare, which means it irped at us. It did a big CME right in our direction, and a couple of days ago it did that too, which means at this moment, if you'll all just crane your necks to the north, and which you might really do if you're on a high enough hill and look north, you might see the wraith-like veils of the Aurora Borealis. We're seeing it here. I'm not, because I'm stuck in Seattle in city lights, but my son is, who's camping up in the mountains, and it's a really quite spectacular, very special event.
Wow. Now, is he seeing aurora up there, Ken?
Yeah, we're seeing it up here, and if you're high enough out away from the city lights, they're seeing it here, and then across the north in Montana, but it's a middle latitude alert and warning, so who knows? Even there in Missouri, if you're up high enough under clear skies and you look north, you might see some glimmer going along the horizon, northeast, northward.
All right, well, now's the time, people. It's 3 o'clock in the morning here in mid-Missouri, so if you're up and you want to take a look outside, this is about as dark as it gets. So, all right, so what else? Okay, Kent, go on.
Well, anyway, I love the music, and it could be that we really are stardust, according to Sagan and others. We share that solar galactic interchange of material that really makes up who we are, and maybe even at the soul level, I don't know. That's speculative. But anyway, my background is I came from Utah down into California in about 1966 to teach college.
Okay.
And it was like going to Mars. And, there I settled for a long time. I was around during the Joni Mitchell days, the 60s. And I saw that amazing witness firsthand, deep ingrained in the cultural movement of the 60s, and it was really amazing. It was like a window into another kind of universe. Well, I taught art for many years, and was quite interested in getting other people to try to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd teach classes with people from all walks of life,
right,
and all ages. And I began experimenting with art and sculpture projects, as well as visualizations to help people begin to do what they did when they were kids, and that's look inside of their minds and perceive things through more than one aspect. Because we're intellectual and we're also emotional and intuitive, and I was interested in regaining all those type of perspectives, and that's what I'm doing on cyberspaceorbit.com. I'm trying to look at things multidimensionally. And by the way, join us there too. Cyberspace, all one word, cyberspaceorbit, all one word, .com, and because I'm a visual type of person, and I try to make these theories we're going to be talking about visual.
Yeah, and if I could jump in real fast, if you do go to the website, you'll be amazed. There's some great imagery there. Give it a chance to load up. Some really cool stuff there. I couldn't agree more, Kent, that this whole idea of getting back to childhood and that whatever we had at that time, a lot of older people seem to have lost it, and being able to get that back does seem to be one of the solutions maybe to some of the problems we're experiencing right now across the whole planet. So,
well, we go through different cultural periods too, and in the 50s they wanted us all. There was the Sputnik era. Remember?
Sure.
We call those days.
Yeah, Yuri Gagarin and all those guys. Sure.
Well, that was
a little bit after Sputnik, I guess, but
it was the Cold War and the space race, and they tried to talk a whole lot of us, high school students and college students, into becoming engineers, as chemists, and so on. And I was on my way doing that too, so I have a little bit of background. But the Eisenhower Commission was encouraging us seriously to do that, but I don't know. I went into college, and it seemed too slow. It wasn't fast enough.
Yeah,
well, I'm an impatient redhead.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, and that's the argument of so many children. Interestingly enough, you know, when they go to school, it's like then the kids aren't stupid. It's just they're bored stiff. It's too slow, and I think it goes on and on and on throughout most of our educational institutions. So.
So yeah, so I switched to art, and next thing I knew, I was in a painting studio, and I was gaping at this blank canvas, and with no particular rules, anything goes. But the main thing is explore.
Right, I love it.
So you know that sort of training. I'm trained that way. My training is specifically to kind of go out into the out of the box, into the edges of things, like an old hound dog. Think of it that way. And I grab a bone and I fetch it back, and then I dump it in cyberspace.
right. Well, and that's something that's obvious when you go to orbit, people. You'll understand very soon that this is not a narrowly focused endeavor. There is tangents that go throughout our experience, and there are things that are very artistic in nature. Kent actually touches on some political stuff, because in the world that we have today, you got to look at that stuff too. Of course, we look at the cosmic stuff, what's going on off our planet as well as on it. And yeah, there's just that big picture thing, being able to look at things with a broader view is another thing that's real important. So,
well, some of the things we've been looking at in orbit over the years, it's been 10 years now at least.
Amazing.
10 years. And a lot of astronomical stuff, which has always fascinated me. And looking at the planets, there's a lot going on with Mars now and Saturn,
right.
Jupiter. And the most amazing stellar search that I've done is looking through. See, on the Internet, we have some groovy things we can do now. And one of the things you can look through spacecraft that are in orbit around the Earth a million miles out, like the SOHO spacecraft, mm-hmm. is trained right on the sun. And boy, I'll tell you something, of all the sleuths and investigations I've done that jolted me away from my college astronomy classes, it's been watching the sun and the things, shenanigans going on and around the sun. I've seen things that I let's use a 60s term. It blew my mind.
Yep, and I know some of those things you're talking about. There's nothing like watching SOHO, and you might explain a little bit to the listeners what SOHO is. But yeah, man, God, over the last years, Kent, we have seen so many things through the eyes of SOHO that are just, like you say. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, at least so far, we just don't have an answer for some of them. So.
Well, the SOHO spacecraft, and we're right in the middle of this sunstorm right now, so this is perfect. The SOHO spacecraft is an eye in the sky with a set of various cameras trained on the sun. Some of the cameras look at the corona. They have a mask that blocks out the face of the sun so you can watch the corona.
Okay.
And through the X-ray spectrum, and I'd like to look at the Earth through the X-ray spectrum.
Yeah, no kidding.
And One of the cameras, you get down and look at, it's called the SOHO cameras actually look right down on the face of the sun, and the LASCO cameras, which are all on the same spacecraft, look at the corona. And then there's another spacecraft called TRACE, which gets you right down close, looking at the amazing plasma shindigs that are going on down up close. And it's just, I don't know what it is about the sun, but boy, it's the center of our solar system, and maybe mythologically correspondent to what we call soul, you know?
Right, I would agree with that for sure. Yeah, you know, before I brought you on the air, I wanted to prep the people a little bit, and I was digging around for some stories, and I found a number of different stories. One titled "Solar Storm Could Spark Catastrophe." Another one, of course, talking about the magnetic field of the Earth, which apparently seems to be weakening, at a greater rate than it has been over the time that they've been measuring it. And that, of course, is something that's a whole nother can of worms. They talk about this stuff as if they know it, but they've only been measuring for 150 years. And 150 years ago, the means of measurement weren't very good. So I think they kind of got a blind eye towards some of this stuff. But anyway, they're talking about magnetic reversals, and that, I think, can be related to solar activity. There's another story here about a sunspot grows to 20 times the size of Earth. Now, I think that's 652, that sunspot area 652. Is that the one that you said just blew a little bit earlier?
Well, it's been blowing steady like a railgun for the last for the last week. And, yeah, it just blew an M8 star.
Wow.
Now, when was it, a year ago? Last
October,
November?
Sure.
We saw the biggest flare probably ever in history, and that includes observation history and any kind of rumor of in prehistory time,
right.
It blew up to X-48. Now, X-class is the biggest category of a flare, and then it goes up beyond and beyond and beyond. Well, this was an X-48. It goes up into Y flare and Z flare, and it was incredible. When it blew, it was off more towards the eastern... the western rim of the sun, and mm-hmm. So it missed us.
Right.
Or only just sort of careened, glancing below.
Yeah. Hey, Ken, why don't you explain to people real fast about that? About these flares. First of all, maybe we could talk a little bit about the levels. It goes, like, I think it goes C class, then M class, then X, and also maybe talk a little bit about coronal mass ejections that are related to these flares, and maybe it's a three-dimensional space, and sometimes people have a difficult time thinking about that. And maybe you could describe again how those sunspot areas are sometimes what they call geo-effective, and what that means to us down here. So,
well, you can see them on the face of the sun, and sometimes with the naked eye. Be careful, but if the sun comes up in the morning and it's kind of misty, and you're looking through a volume of atmosphere, or if you have welding glasses or really thick sunglasses, you can see this this flare. It's a series of dark spots now more toward the right or the west,
right,
of the face of the sun, but you can see it. And they become geo-effective when they are somewhere in center position. For instance, this sunspot 652 complex is still geo-effective and probably will be for the next couple of days. But these regions are like electrical vortexes, and sometimes they throw off what you call a flare. Sometimes these flares are like big sparks, and sometimes they also correspond to a coronal mass ejection, which is solar material coming right at us, and there's different kinds of solar material. Some is very lightweight, protons, electrons, but sometimes it spits plasma right at us, and this is like many, many hydrogen bombs of force coming
right
at us, and it fans out in a big funnel. And if it strikes the Earth, and if the solar winds are blowing in the right direction, if it strikes the Earth, then it hits the Earth, and the Earth, like a big Nerf ball, will the magnetic field around the Earth will collapse. Generally what happens is it makes for a really beautiful aurora in the north, but potentially it could be quite devastating depending on the force of the coronal mass ejection. I've seen it in 98 around Christmas time. I saw atmosphere leak off the Earth forever because of a CME that hit the Earth, and there happened to be a spacecraft train up in the northern polar region, and it took a picture of atmosphere going bye-bye forever. So, it can be potentially a very powerful thing, and what's interesting to me is maybe the effects it might have on the human nervous system.
We certainly, a couple things that you made me think of. With regard to Mars, there are some recent theories that talk about that may have been how Mars actually lost its atmosphere. People have talked about a long time ago, millions of years ago, or whatever the time frame might be, that that Mars actually had an atmosphere that may have not been all that different from Earth. There was most likely water, and of course you and me know that there's still water on Mars. But pardon me. Anyway, there's some people that say that a big solar shot may have actually torn the atmosphere right off of Mars.
Could be. Mars definitely was once a blue planet. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. Geologically, you can see that the ocean bed, our Opportunity and rover up there right now, that's what it's doing. It's rolling around in an ocean bed,
right.
An old ocean bed. And so it once had seas, and there are various places on the internet where they show Mars reconstructed and the way it may have looked eons ago when it was a blue planet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and you know what interests me, Mike?
What's that?
Well, you know, I'm part scientist and part mythologist and part this crazy artist. But you know, the legends of Babylonia where the confusion of languages and so on. I just see that the pants now, I'll toss it out. Well, I wonder if that was a solar strike, you know, to hit certain regions of the earth in such a manner that, the human nervous systems were short-circuited, and maybe the brain was formatted.
Well, you know, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the work of Immanuel Velikovsky, but Velikovsky actually wrote a book back in the 60s. It was called People in Amnesia, and he actually had a similar theory that he related it to the to language. He believes that, or believed, he's no longer with us, but Velikovsky believed that at least one time in the history of the planet, which of course goes back, you know, millions and billions of years, so there are obviously things that could have happened here that we will never know about. But in any case, Velikovsky believed that there was a global language, that people actually shared a language throughout the entire planet, and that something happened. And he doesn't necessarily identify it as a solar shot or an asteroid impact or a shift in the magnetic field or whatever. But he believes that something happened that neurologically, just like you say, changed the physiology of the human brain, and that is the source of the story of the Tower of Babel and this confusion of the languages. So that's certainly something that's worth thinking about, I think.
Well, you know, that's where we connect with everything out there, is that one of our human aspects is that we're kind of like a big walking bundle of hamburger.
Yeah.
Another aspect is that we're electromagnetic.
Absolutely.
Which means, you know, we literally radiate energy. Mm-hmm. And they call them brain waves. Well, it comes off all portions of our body. So, mm-hmm. You can't say, well, I'm doing a brain wave and it stops there 5 feet out. You know, waves keep going, and they intermingle with the waveforms of the entire universe.
Right, so we really are connected. All these things are sort of interconnected with their electrical magnetic field sort of interacting with one another, regardless of whether it's a human field or this computer screen that I'm looking at or whatever. So,
and, you know, Einsteinian theory, this fascinates me too. Einstein said that at the speed of light, all this wild stuff happens, you know, time dilation, infinite mass, and so on.
Right.
And like when you look at light, almost it's like looking at the midland between the physical world and something else. Well, you know what? We're all traveling at the speed of light.
Yeah.
Welcome to the speed of light.
Right.
Yeah, we're there.
Yeah.
So at certain dimensions of our being, you know, we're already doing all those stunts that Einstein says happens at the speed of light.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I mean, the whole quantum physics thing really kind of threw a monkey wrench into all that. You know, when they finally said, "Well, look, at the subatomic level, things don't always act like particles. They sometimes act like waves, and they sometimes act like particles." Well, right then, that basically tells you that at the core of your being, you are nothing but light waves.
Well, even particle physics, you know, is kind of facing an impasse right now because they're having one heck of a hard time finding the basic underlying what they call the God particle,
sure.
The Higgs particle.
Yeah,
they haven't found it. Right. They haven't found it. And recently out of the big accelerators in Europe at CERN and DESE, they put out a statement that it may not exist.
Huh.
So deep down, as you explore matter through the molecular, the atomic, the subatomic, down, deeper within, you know, there may not be a particle there. It may be something else.
Right. It's almost this whole creator-created dynamic that I think about sometimes where, you know, the seeker will find, you know what I mean? The more we look, the more that will be revealed. We sort of create it as we investigate it. And I honestly think that is the big impasse of science, that it can never reconcile the fact that it just cannot get that final answer. And that becomes the synthesis between the scientific and the mystical. And that's a place where most of these guys are not willing to go, you know.
Well, you know, it also frees you up, and even though there it is frustrating that you know you explore an idea and you think you've got an answer, well, it gives way to another question on and on. But awe is cool for an artist anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, that I enjoy it, and that's what actually keeps me going, is the fact that the one solution will give way to another question, and on it goes. And what this says to us as human beings is it's okay to free the imagination, and that's what I've kind of been, that's been my soapbox for many, many years, is getting back in touch with your imagination. Cut it loose, go out there and dream, because, you know, the universe, they say, is infinite. So you're free to dream. You're free to dream, and the probability that what you might dream or imagine, image, mage,
right,
magi,
right,
what
right.
you might imagine, it has a probability of being there, you know,
right.
And you're talking about infinity, so cut loose and imagine and go for it. We live in a rational age, which is fine, and it's a sort of a filter that we use, but it's not the only filter. It's not the only filter, because we're the most human aspect, I think, is our potential to dream. And there are cultures like the Sinoy and Malaysia where they make a big deal out of that. People wake up from their dream state at night, and then they sit around the campfire. By the way, we're all sitting around here.
That's right. Don't forget.
And they describe their dreams, and they consider that, you know, significant.
Wow. Well, okay. I think that's a good. I think that's a good opportunity to take a break. Good time to break up for a second here. We're going to put on a little bit of music, Kent. I'll be back with you in about 5 minutes. I'm going to go take a break from the campfire here and go get a little bit of something to drink. And we'll be back with Kent Stedman from CyberspaceOrbit.com. And we'll be talking with Kent for at least another hour, if I can talk him into it. And we'll be back right after that. Hey, Kent, thanks a lot. And we'll be back in just a minute, okay?
See you in a few.
All right.
I can't run a bridge before the cavern of night. Darkness alive with possibility. No place to win for twinkling lights. Trying to catch the sender was coming to me. Somewhere a saxophone slides. changes like a wet pipe dripping down my neck. Gives me a chill, sounds like danger, but I can't stop moving till I cross the detector.
All right, we're back.
Howdy.
Hey, Kent. All right. Hey, everybody. Radio Orbit on KOPN 89.5 FM. Mid Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and music of the world. Also, Radio Orbit. And tonight we're with Kent Stedman, and he's on the line here and being courteous enough to talk to us in the middle of the night. And, Kent, let's get back into what we were talking about before. We're talking about the sun and, well, just lots of different stuff. So I'm just going to kind of let you get right back into whatever we were talking about before.
Well, let's reinforce the magic again. Howdy, everybody out there. You know, we're aware of you, and it's nice to be with you, and here we are all. We are, all are, conservative, liberal, losers, finders, and we're sitting around a campfire here poking the flames and talking, telling some tales, and that's what it's all about right now. So, you know, join in with us in this in these imaginings, and we'll get down to some pretty interesting and, I hope, stimulating conversation here. Now, where were we?
All right, let's see. Well, you know what? You mentioned that we were talking about the sun, and we were talking about imagination, and we were talking about these words, and you made me think about how you mentioned the word soul and how we call the sun soul. Of course, that's a Spanish word for it, and then we have the soul inside ourselves, and soul also is a fish, and it also means the word. It also means one, as in the soul, the only one. So anyway, all these words have these deeper meanings, and I think imagination is one of those ones that you hit on. It's the same way you mentioned the word magic involved in there, and magi and mage, and these are things that are so important for the human spirit. And let's just talk some more about that.
Well, imagination, magi, mage, magic, they all come from M-A-G, which is a root that, as far as I can translate it to my best ability, it means M-A-G equals to see. Oh, see. So see. What you're doing with the imagination is you allow yourself to see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where the root seer, seer came from. And so... well, you know, the best thing is to do is use all of your perceptions, right brain, left brain, mm-hmm. you know, go out with your imagination and see, and then filter it with your binary aspect of yourself, more mm-hmm. earthbound, use logic and try to see how it applies to our position here on Earth, which appears to be more up and down, you and me, this and that, black and white,
right.
You know.
The whole duality thing.
And so, you know, creative people are culturally assigned to see, you know, to go out and see, and scientific people are culturally assigned to analyze. And so, and we all have these aspects within ourselves, you know.
Right.
So some of us are one way, some of us are another way. And it's interesting to see how this percolates down into politics and mm. how people are dancing like on a hot skittle now,
right.
And
right.
In the maw of incredible change, there's a lot of things going on,
mm-hmm.
and you can see it in our politics. So when I I try to look at all things in my investigations, including the cosmos, the ancient cultures, what may have come before us, what's happening now, and how it's influencing everybody, and how it's making us all do our earth dance.
The earth dance, a great way to put it. Yeah, you know, Kent, you mentioned a minute ago, you were talking about using the brain, the right brain, the left brain, the whole system in order to perceive the world around us. And that's something that I've been really interested in lately is this, you know, it's you may or may not be familiar with this work, but anyway, the heart is something that's recently been determined that up to 65% of the cells in your heart, actual heart cells, are neurons. And it's actually a confirmation of sort of the old, what the sages have all told us, and that is to think with your heart. Well, it turns out that this isn't just a metaphor, really. The heart actually does have a tremendous number of neurons, and these neurons are no different than the ones that are in your brain. And so making that connection between the two, the heart mind and the brain mind, again, that balance in between is where the answers lie, I think. And I think, again, we see that in our politics and in our culture and in our everyday life. We see, in many cases, a disconnect between that heart mind and the brain mind. And I think to reconnect there is something that we have to do as a species in order to survive, but it's also something that ties right in with that relearning of imagination.
Well, everybody out there, you know, put the question to you. Don't you feel things with your heart, you know?
Right.
Human beings feel things with our heart, and it's powerful stuff. I mean, your brain can be twittering along, you know, doing brain stuff, but when the heart kicks in, you know, that all kind of goes by the wayside.
Sure.
That all becomes sort of a lot of gibberish out there in the analytical things, and we're really propelled most profoundly by what we feel deep down inside. And can, you know, if you can feel it, sense it in your heart, and paying attention to it, well, you can't help but pay attention to it, because that's a powerful mojo,
right,
feeling and emotion. And there are just so many different aspects to us. The Native American people that Mike and I have had the privilege of being able to meet and discuss things with, you know, they regard their perceptual world in more than one dimension. It's like a sixth dimension.
Right.
You know, you have the mind, you have the emotions, you have the heart, you have the intellect,
right,
and you have the physical strength, you know, the physical. And they have totems as something that was hard to understand when there was cross-culture a couple 300 years ago. They'll symbolize these different aspects of the human being with the totemic sort of things, like the bear is physical and the eagle is far-seeing and the sun is the soul and the orca floating out with its family out there, very powerful emotional beings. Orcas.
Well, I'll tell you what, anybody who doesn't think that the dolphins and the orcas are not perfectly sentient creatures, well, they just aren't looking. These are incredible creatures, and I believe what you say, you can have a relationship with them. So,
and then things change over time, you know, different influences and the way we insist upon one another that we model and look at the world, these things change, and
right,
sometimes for the better, that is. It utilizes more human potential, and sometimes for the worse, where everything sort of shrinks down to like a raisin, and you're supposed to look at the world in very limited and prescribed ways. Well, you know, humans have been on this earth for a long, long time.
Right. And maybe
probably
longer
than anybody even can understand.
And maybe more than once.
Oh, yeah.
You know, maybe not continuously, but maybe, who knows? I mean, the thing is, like you say, I mean, who the heck knows? It's, you know, billions of years, and we look back a few thousand. We talk about history, and we go back, you know, we go back, what, 7,000 years, maybe maximum 5,000 B.C. before we get really confused.
Well, you know, I'm in the midst of the investigation. It's got my hair standing on. You know, it really sends chills up and down my body because, you know, Mike knows that for years I played music, and for a long time I played Celtic music.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I was able to hang out with some Irish guys, and I became really interested in Ireland. And I loved the Irish people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, recently there's a place in Ireland, inland from Dublin, called the Boyne Valley, and it's a pretty sizable valley. I'll have to go there and pace around it to actually get a sense of size, but, it, you know, it's 5 miles by 10 miles, so that's, what, 500 square miles, I think.
Right, it's a big area, for sure.
And a big area. Well, I started looking, and I found a map just by chance of the Boyne Valley, and in this Boyne Valley are some monuments there that are these immense cairns or mounds. I mean, they're huge.
Now let's go back and talk a little bit about where this is at exactly. This is in the Boyne Valley, is in Ireland, is that, that's right?
It's in Ireland.
Okay.
And if you go to Dublin, you get in a car and you drive for about an hour or so, and you end up heading west, and you end up in this valley, which is the main feature in the valley is the Boyne River.
Okay.
And this Serpentine River that runs through the valley and scattered around in a really interesting arrangement, which I'll go into in a minute, are these huge mounds. Now, we have mounds in the United States.
Sure.
In fact, there are mounds right there in Missouri.
Yes,
you know?
St. Louis, Mound City, right? I think they used to call it so.
Well, mounds are really puzzling because they're huge to start with, and the mounds in the Boyne Valley, known as Newgrange, Nauf, and Douth, and the Hill of Tara, and then smaller mounds and the henges and stall mounds, you know, stones that are arranged in really interesting patterns and situations, like Stonehenge.
Sir, okay, I was going to ask. Yes, it's something similar, at least, conceptually, at least.
Well, anyway, if you fly like an eagle up away from the Boyne Valley and you look down, or you look at a map, which I did of the Boyne Valley,
right,
you begin to notice that these mounds are interrelated. Even though they're miles apart, they're interrelated in a very interesting way. Well, my intuition served me quite well, because it looked to me like a star map. Mound here, mound over there, mound over there. They look like positions of stars. And so
right.
I ran across some mythology in Ireland that equates some of these ancient people, which, by the way, these mounds predate Giza by 1,000 years. They go way back.
Wow.
And so it may be, you know, kind of like Eden, mythologically, the earliest.
Wow. Okay. Well, listen, that's a good place to take a break. We're just about at the top of the hour. Kent, when we come back, I'm going to pull up the website at the break here, and I think you've got some imagery there. I think you've got some overlays of the Boyne Valley with some star systems, and it looks like a whole bunch of stuff. So maybe we can get a little bit deeper into this when we come back at the top of the hour.
It's a wild tale, speaking of mine.
All right. I can't wait to hear more of it. And we got another hour with Kent Stedman, if we can keep him up that long. And we'll talk about this archaeological, mythological mystery that Kent is working on in Ireland. And we'll talk a little bit more about the creative and imagination and all that stuff, too, hopefully, before the end of the night. And we'll be back... We'll be back just in a minute here, if I can get my CD player figured out. So anyway, back with Kent Stedman in a minute. Kent, thanks for everything.
My great-grandfather was a welder.
Tragically Hip on KOPN. That was Terrarium from Day for Night. And it's 4 o'clock in the morning on KOPN 89.5 FM, Columbia, Missouri, and surrounding areas. This is Radio Orbit, the inaugural edition, with a great show and a super guest on the line, my friend Kent Stedman. Kent, you still there?
I'm still here.
All right, cool.
I'm dreaming away about Ireland, as a matter of fact.
All right, well, we ended the last hour just a few minutes ago, and Kent was telling us about an area in Ireland called the Boyne Valley, where they located some interesting monuments and some mounds. And, I went to the website, Kent, while we were on the break there, and I'm looking at some of the layovers between these mounds and star maps and everything, and it is pretty incredible. So why don't you lay it out for us here and let everyone know what we're looking at.
Well, to do so, come with us, everybody out there, because what we're going to do now is kind of take a little trip in time.
Yeah, let's give out the website again real fast, www.cyberspaceorbit.com. That's CYBERSPACEORBIT.com, no spaces, except for the word space in the middle there, but cyberspaceorbit.com, and check it out. It's pretty cool stuff.
Well, the people that built these mounds in the Boyne Valley, east of or west of Dublin, apparently did so with position of the mounds in mind. In other words, they must have had some long pieces of string to figure this all out.
That's right.
Or very sophisticated surveying equipment, because what they did is, A, they laid out all these mounds in relationship to one another to, first of all, the Pleiades star constellation. And I mean, I found a map of the Pleiades, and as an artist, I pasted it transparently right over the Boyne Valley, and the stars in the constellation and the mound structures, the major ones, line up perfectly.
Right, that's what I'm looking at right now, and I can't believe the image I'm looking at. So.
And I couldn't believe it, because think of that. Think of the implications of that.
Yeah.
And we're talking that some people, whoever they were, we'll go into that for a minute, because then you have to go into mythology.
Mm-hmm.
But some people that were around a long time ago, 1,000 years before the pyramids in Egypt, and they were building these immense mounds. I mean, immense mounds.
Right.
Under the Mount of Terror, I'll quickly say they've recently, by using high technology, they found a temple underneath Terra.
Oh my God.
And so that got me interested right away. But the thing that really made my hackles rise was positioning the map of the Pleiades over the mound system in the Boyne Valley, and bingo, they lined up. And then, B, they have a kind of interesting curve, like a spiral arrangement to them. And so I then took the spiral that's found in what you call the Fibonacci series, and without getting too technical, it's a type of geometry that's been known about since ancient times called the golden mean.
Okay.
And if you draw a bunch of lines and this and that working out the geometry, you'll notice a spiral. Mm-hmm. It's the same spiral that's found in the nautilus shell, and it's the same spiral that's found the way the sunflower seeds swirl toward the center. And it's the same way water looks when it's going down the drain, and it's the same way our Milky Way spiral galaxy geometrically and mathematically arranges itself. Mm-hmm. So then, to make a long story short, I cut and pasted a transparency over the top of the Boyne Valley, and I already had the Pleiades constellation, and here was this beautiful spiral going right through the mound system, through all perfectly, through all the mounds, and spiraling up to the right and top, and spiraling to center over an area that really interested me, because where the center of the spiral positioned itself, there was no real mound up there, but there was a lake. Now, if you got any Celtic Blarney, if you kissed the Blarney Stone like myself, playing Irish music for 20 years, you realize that, and if you hang out with the Native American people, you realize that bodies of water are very, very important to the ancient people. You know, they just felt that there were correspondences in their belief system and their understanding of the universe. Well, I got a hold of a couple of Irish guys that live near in the Boyne Valley, and references to their websites are apparent up there. Dalfcom being the specific reference. I got a hold of this guy named Michael over there, and I said, "Well, what is that lake?" Well, he didn't know. He lived just 4 miles away from it, but he'd never explored the lake itself. So he says, "Well, hang on." He says, "I'll go look." And well, he has to walk south of the highway through several fields, and he stumbles upon this expanse of about 5 acres, which is a marsh lake. And the center of the lake, where there was a whole family of swans right there, which
holy cow,
which is important to mythology.
Is that the photo that I'm looking at on the website?
Yeah, you'll see the photo.
I'll be darned. Yeah, I see the swan right there.
But that lake, oh, man.
Holy cow.
You know, what does it bring up in terms of your Celtic mythology, the lake?
Lady of the Lake and the whole idea of...
The Lady of the Lake, the Sword of Destiny.
Right. The divine feminine sort of thing, too, comes to mind, you know?
And it's in eyeshot about a mile away from the Douth Mound, which is the oldest one.
You know, Kent, if I can jump in real fast, too, as I'm looking at this, I see the... where the lake is located, it looks like the area there is called Maya. Is that correct?
Well, it's underneath the pole star Maya, which is in the constellation Pleiades. The name of the lake was found out.
Right.
Nobody knew. It's called Ballyboy Lake. Ballyboy.
Right. Wow. Well, that's crazy, because I'm seeing all these different words on this map, and all of these words, you know, are interesting words in and of themselves. The word Maya, of course, a very interesting word and has lots of different meanings. And of course, hey, right now, and we don't have to talk too much about it, but it is the Mayan New Year tomorrow, and today is what the Mayans called, and what anybody who practices the 13-month, 28-day calendar, today is what's called the day out of time. So happy day out of time there, Barbara.
Well, Mike and I like to talk at length about the sort of alchemy of words, and how they weren't just cooked up by accident. Certain words.
And on your map here, the other word is called Knoweth, or Knowth, K-N-O-W-T-H, and obviously that looks like the word know, and it looks like the word knoweth. And so these are things that are not by accident, they're not coincidental, and I think they're significant. So, man, really cool. Keep going, Kent.
And the Ballyboy, the root in that. Bale.
Bale. Yeah.
The eye of the sun.
Right. Wow.
And now, see, the ancients, a place like that was really, really important because it's a marsh lake. It's quite small, just a couple hundred yards across in the summertime, but during the rainy season, it'll expand out over 5 acres of reeds. Well, reeds are very important to Irish mythology. Mm-hmm. To start with, they made stuff out of the reeds.
Right.
And, of course, it would be a nexus for all kinds of wildlife, including herbs and medicine, which they'd use for medicine. And also, they felt that some of these lakes had curative powers. In fact, not very far away north along the Mattock is a place called Slane's Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And Slane was one of the ancient races, Irish races, a Fearbold, they call him Fearbold, and we'll talk about these different people in a moment, but okay. That was his hill. That's where St. Patty went up to hold the snakes at bay. So it's famous for St. Patrick. It's famous for this ancient Fearbold king named Slane.
Right.
And in the mythology, they talk about Slane's well. And I'm beginning to wonder if the lake, even though they've assigned that to another place,
that it might be Slane's well.
It might be Slane's well. Well, the mythology around that, the word slain,
mm-hmm.
it comes from, you know, they took the slain warriors. The slain warriors
right.
down to Slane's well, and they'd toss them, they'd throw them, put them in the water, and resurrect them.
Right. So this was a rejuvenating, reincarnating water, or something like that.
So is this Slane's well? Well, we don't know, but you know, there are a lot of other things. The marsh lake, for instance, has these disgusting little critters in them called leeches. Well, they're mm-hmm. not so disgusting because the leeches have a certain in their saliva, they have a certain actual healing properties for them that the ancients knew about this.
So all the stories of
wounds, they you know, they use leeches on wounds,
right,
they use
right.
leeches on arthritis. You know?
Right. So those old medical stories weren't based on lunacy. They actually had some sort of a experiential benefit from the practice that they recognized.
Well, yeah, and in Slane's well, there were the four sacred leeches.
Oh,
and an ancient Fearbold or the Danann princes.
Wow.
A healer would take them down there. And well, the thing that interests me, too, is that, like the Native Americans, when there's a place like this that's been used for thousands of years, it becomes kind of important, even sacred, you know. And sacred places like this, like the Mayan centers, they'll toss stuff in there and they'll, you know, they'll give offerings and so on. And so the next question is, what's down in that lake?
Oh, man.
Now, the people, according to Irish stories and mythology, there were migrations of various... See, when the Celts came up, from their copper mines in northern Spain, there were people already living up there, and they were, that's where your Hobbit stories and Middle Earth stories,
right, right,
because these people were magical, which means highly advanced. You know?
Let's talk a little bit about the history of the people a little bit, and maybe you could relate it to Tolkien a little bit, or somehow relate it to, so the listeners can kind of get a current day grasp on what we kind of think these people might have been like.
Well, the Irish encountered when they got there.
Where the hell they might have come from, Kent?
Well, they encountered a people right off the bat called the Dedannan, the Tuatha De Danann.
Okay.
I played music, Irish Celtic music that's in homage to the Tuatha De Danann. And, you know, who were they? Well, it's hard to, we don't know, but the tribe of Dan, or the followers of Diana, you know, that all seems to correspond somehow. The huntress people. And if you go back far enough in the mythology, you find that they were sort of tall, bronze-skinned, sort of like the Greeks, the Greek civilization, highly advanced civilization
right.
of the time. And they were considered magical. A lot of stories. For instance, they could appear and disappear at will, things like that. So you have sort of the high elven culture similar to the Tolkien myth in the people of the Dedannan.
Okay.
But now, prior to the Dedannan, there was a bunch called the Firbolg, F-I-R-B-O-L-G, and they seem to be a sort of a difficult bunch, because the Dedannan and the Firbolg were constantly at war, and the Firbolg apparently lived, they were more a rough-cut species, and they lived underground.
Hmm.
In caves and tunnels and so on. Now, who were they? I don't know. Were they Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal types? I don't know. But or were they something else? They're connected to the dragon, you know, and the serpent in mythology, the fearful beings. And then prior to that, there was a very early race which were called the Fomorian. Now, these guys, these guys were aquatic.
Oh, man.
They were aquatic, and they were really scary, like the Nomos of, and who are the Dogon?
Sure, the Dogons and the African tribe, yeah.
Yeah, they were considered people of the sea. The Scottish and Irish called them the Blue Men or the Silky.
Huh.
Or the Silky, or the, you know, later the legends of the mermaid and the mermen came from it, and they came out of the sea, and they entered the valley through subterranean passages, ways, and caves that connected to the sea.
Huh.
And so you go back and back and back through all these tiers of mythology, encountering all these people, but what we have there is an amazing architectural wonder in the Boyne Valley, in all of these mounds that are surveyed and laid out precisely under the Pleiades constellation, and precisely innate within the geometry of the golden spiral, the golden mean, and the spirals towards this lake.
Well, I tell you something, Kent. You know, people tend to look at mythology with an idea that mythology is not real. It's not reality. It's just a parable or a metaphor to try to get a point across, to try to teach something or whatever. And I include in the use of the word mythology, I include the Bible. You know, I include the Quran. I include these ancient texts of all these old cultures that are the collected mythology of that culture. But I think that what we're learning is that as we see all of these monuments that seem to be placed throughout the world, all over the planet, things that defy our explanation as to how they were. How they were done, how they were completed, how they, for example, this Boyne Valley thing that we're looking at with you, how the heck did they, were they able to construct the positions of these mounds and these monuments without knowing, without being very highly sophisticated people? So you start to think that the mythology, the mythology may certainly be metaphorical in on a certain level, but there's also truth in some of this mythology, I think, is what we're learning, and we cannot take it as fantasy, and that these peoples and that the stories that they related in their mythology are very possibly real stories.
Well, that's how they kept the history and they kept the news. It's through oral tradition, you know, and these guys that did that had to be very specifically trained to carry these myths from one generation to another, word for word.
Right, without corrupting the story, right?
Yeah, and even today, the Irish Shanachie still goes from village to village, and part minstrel, part poet. That's where the bardic tradition came from.
Right, and it's what you and I see in the Lakota traditions. So.
Right. And, well, anyway, that's not an arbitrary task, these people, because it comes up through the Druids and the Bardic system, and they have to be able to relate these tales perfectly, you know, which is, in a way, a better deal than sort of the written word, you know, which gets tossed around. And, just because something's written in a book doesn't mean, you know, what it is. You know, we're talking about Time Magazine and Playboy. You know, what it is modern mythology.
Right.
And one thing I've noticed in a critical analysis of mythology is the myth hangs on. You know, it doesn't go away. Now, compare it to science, where you have one theory eclipsing another theory.
Mm-hmm.
On and on and on. A scientific theory... even Einstein said he knew it only had a slice of the pie, and Newton and all those. Well, they change rapidly. In a span of 50 years, you've got one scientific theory giving way to another. But some of these myths have stayed around for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So, in trying to juggle science and myth, you know, what do you say? Well, the myth is almost more permanent, you know. Whether it stands up to scientific analysis or not, well, that's a debate. But it doesn't go away. It's still there.
Right.
And I've often wondered if this world we live in isn't so much condensed myth.
Yeah, something I think that you coined the term, I think you call it the myth stream.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real interesting concept, and I think you're right about that. My opinion on mythology changed years ago when I read and was introduced to Joseph Campbell, and boy, I tell you what, there's a whole lot there, and it's stuff that that's really valuable, and I think it tells us a lot about the history of our planet, the real history of our planet, and really the potential of ourselves as human beings. What are we really? You know what I mean? What are we really capable of? And our ancestors, I think, would probably not be real pleased about where we're at right now. I think some of our ancestors might think that we're capable of quite a bit more.
Well, when you have a hill or a pyramid or a mound, you know, or a Stonehenge, you know, that goes beyond myth, because you can walk up and stub your toe on it.
Yeah, that's myth, that's myth concretized in the physical, right?
I had an interesting, back when I was just out of college, I went down to Teotihuacan in north of Mexico City. Well, I'm not sure which direction it has been so long, but I climbed up this huge pyramid of the sun in the complex of Teotihuacan, and I barely made it to the top.
Right.
Even as a young, fit man, I was sitting up there on this immense pyramid, looking at another pyramid nearby, the Pyramid of the Moon, and a huge complex there. And all of a sudden, here comes this movie, talk about myth, across myth, this movie company comes up, and here's this guy dressed in this bat cape. They hustle us off to all one side on the apex of the pyramid, and they start blowing things up and throwing dummies and stuff over the edge of the pyramid and filming it at the same time. And I'm going, holy moly. Talk about cross myth streams.
Right. No kidding. Now, what that was back when I'm sure it wasn't highly regulated, and you could probably get around down there and kind of go where you wanted and not have a whole lot of trouble with security or things like that. Like today, you can't even get near the top of the Pyramid of the Sun, you know?
Oh, you can't?
No, not a chance in hell.
Yeah, well, everybody was walking up to the top of
it. Oh, man.
You know, that pyramid, apparently, I met a friend down there by accident. He was an archaeology student at my college. He was there, too, and he said, well, these pyramids are like the Pyramid of the Sun. It's built, here we go, water, and the importance of water. It's
right.
Built over a sacred well deep down in its guts.
Mm-hmm.
It's built over a well. And there is a lot of muttering and whispering going around amongst some of the guides and so on. The underneath this pyramid, are extensive passageways and tunnels. And one guide said they go all the way to the sea, from central Mexico to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And the same legends, for instance, are abundant in the Boyne Valley. You know, there's quite a vast subterranean tunnel complex that connect. Well, they found the temple underneath the Tara, the Big Hill Tara.
Right. Another interesting word, Tara, by the way. Anyway.
And then I get a call from a friend that you and I know about. He's sort of an ex-forces type, you know, that's been in the government.
Yeah, I know. He
was an encoder, decoder. So he calls me up and he says, he told me a tale. So here we go with an ex-forces tale. He said a friend of his entered some sea caves, an ex-Navy SEAL entered some sea caves south of Dublin somewhere, and they sort of angled up to where they became dry, and he stowed his scuba gear and kept going. Huh. And he was equipped, apparently, for exploration because he explored and kept going for several days.
Wow.
And he came up in some old Irish lady's basement in the Boynton County Heath, in the Boynton Valley. Came up from what appeared to be, you know, her house was built over an old dry well.
Yeah.
And he comes up there, and there's this ex-Navy SEAL and this rather blustery Irish grandma, and they had an interface, and she told him to get the blinkety-blink out of there. And he didn't argue.
Yeah.
So that's a tale for you.
Incredible. Incredible. Well, hey, let's take a break. I'm going to throw a song in the player here, and we got about 30 minutes left, and we'll take a short break here. We're talking to Kent Steadman, incredible conversation, Kent, from cyberspaceorbit.com. Hopefully you're following along with us and enjoying this as much as I am. So we'll be back in just a few minutes here with Kent Steadman.
Check to me.
All right.
Hey.
There we go, Ken. A little bit Pearl Jam on the radio at 4:30 in the AM, KOPN 89.5 FM. Mid-Missouri source for awesome radio, Radio Orbit, here with Kent Stedman. Man, Kent, let's get back to it. We got a half hour. We got, I don't know, we got probably 25 minutes. I'm not going to take any more breaks for the rest of the show here. We'll stop at about 5 to 5 to, I guess, what is it, about 3:30 there? No, about 2:30 there, your time, right?
Yeah.
All right, we'll stop at about 5 minutes till 3 your time, and I'll play one more song to get us out of here, and then I'll turn it over to my friend, Carol Greenspan, who comes in at 5 a.m. every Sunday morning and does she does a show called Jewish Spectrum, and she plays some really cool music. And anyway, so we'll turn it over to her in a half an hour, and in the meantime, we're talking to Kent Stedman. That was Pearl Jam from No Code. That song is called Present Tense, and it's a fitting topic. We need to live in the present tense, not in the past, not in the future. There's only this continuous now. And so speaking of that, let's get on with it, man. What's up?
Let me read you an ode. We were talking about mythology a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
I'm going to read you this verbatim. This was written by an Welsh prince, I think he's one of my ancestors, probably. His nickname was Mad Dog. Anyway, Maddock was his name.
Yeah, I remember a long time ago on the site, maybe a year or two ago, there was a little investigation on him, and it went back into your own roots, and I remember that, Kent.
Well, it goes back into what we've been talking about, which is this incredible array of architectural mounds,
right.
Cairns, passage cairns, whatever they are, in the Boyne Valley. Well, here's this ode, okay?
Okay.
It goes like this. Maddock am I, the son of Owain Gwynedd, with stature large and comely grace adorned, no land at home nor store of wealth, my mind was whole to search the sea.
Holy cow.
Well, anyway, that's what he did. He loaded his crew in this sort of Viking-looking boat,
right.
With a dragon sail. And they, under the tutelage, interestingly enough, of a druid who encouraged him, highly encouraged him to go back to the new world and do some looking around, you know. And that's what he did. And so we're kind of rewriting history. Now, if it's true, around 1150, 1180.
Right.
Maddog Ab Owain Gwynedd set sail, and he traveled up South America along the coast, and then he finally landed with his party in Alabama, at Mobile Bay, Alabama. Now, where he landed is this huge mound complex. Now, the question is, did he build these mounds, or something else, you know, in the United States, and right there in Missouri, you Missourians, there's these incredible, there are tens of thousands of immense mounds. St. Louis was Mound City.
Right.
And
Cahokia, right?
Cahokia, you know, which right. is a huge mound city, which you can still visit.
Right, and remember, there's actually a guy that I need to get in touch with. Maybe we'll get him on the air here one of these days. Maybe we'll get both of you guys on the air, but remember, you hooked me up with him maybe a year ago. But anyway, he's a guy, I think, in the Missouri area here, and he talks about a whole terraform thing that he, I think it's sort of what you're talking about, these series of mounds that are actually not independent. They're actually connected, and when you connect them, something else comes out.
The Missouri Mystery Mound. Now, you folks there should look into that. You've got mounds there, lots of them. One of them, I need to come out there and visit Mike and sort of mill around a little bit, because we're talking about a mound that's far enough in the backwoods, it's still rather undisturbed, and it has entrances and passageways, and it's surrounded by these rather immense sculpted effigies of various animals. And then you go inside it, and boy, you go into another dimension. What this all boils down to is, we're talking about a global civilization, a very high development a long, long time ago, you know, and with the tens of thousands of mounds in the United States and pyramids in every
Every continent, right?
Every continent. And
All of these alignments now, we're seeing these star alignments all over the place now. It wasn't just a it wasn't just a fluke where it happened in one place. We're seeing star alignments all over the globe now.
Well, who was that guy, that Iroquois guy that we met at the Mike and I had the opportunity to visit with some of the traditional elders
In Colorado a couple
of
years ago.
In Colorado a few years ago. Who was the guy? Dwayne, was that his name?
Yeah, his name was Walking Turtle.
Walking Turtle.
Dwayne Walking Turtle, yeah. He lives here in Missouri. Yeah.
Well, I was really interested in talking to him because in my mixed blood, I have one line that goes back to the Passamaquoddy Indians up in...
Pacific Northeast, right?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, the Atlantic Northeast.
Yeah, so I was talking to Walking Turtle about this, and he said, oh, yes, he says, it's very profound in our oral tradition that we met up with some big old redheaded guys and fought them and all kinds of battles.
And these are the Celts, probably.
Yeah, well, when Lewis and Clark tromped out west in their expedition, Meriwether Lewis was he was Welsh himself, and he had heard many rumors about Welsh Indians. and prior expeditions, I'm trying to think of the guy's name.
And we got redheaded mummies they found too, right?
Yeah, prior expedition, George Catlin went out there by himself. He was a lawyer that decided to go out west before everything got disturbed out there and meet with some of the Indians. And he met some tribes that later disappeared due to smallpox infection. One of them was the Mandan Indians.
Yeah, the Mandan.
They're really interesting. He painted their pictures. They're really interesting people. Like, the young women had very pale skin and blue eyes, and they had this silver hair, you know. I mean, silver hair in their early teens. Really beautiful. He said they were beautiful people. Well, some of their words, he understood that they were pure Welsh.
Wow.
And he went all the way to the West Coast, encountering stories of the Welsh Indians. And even though that history and the science is very confused about it all now, the Indians remember it. And now some of these digs that have been going on around the country, down at Spirit Lake in Nevada, and Kennewick Man, they're discovering that perhaps many families lived here, and that there was more than one type of people here. Of course, we give credit to the Native American now for enduring through it all, and keeping this history.
My gosh, I know, and it really was something that was by design meant to be eliminated fully, but it luckily it hasn't been so.
So anyway, it'd be interesting for me to come out sometime to Missouri and talk to some of you Missourians about this, the mounds there.
Right. You know, I'm sure there are some people around here and probably some older folks that know a lot about this stuff. And boy, that's a real interesting investigation that we can look at right here at home. And it's really something that that I'm gonna try to get more involved. I got to get you out here, Kent, and then you'll go hunting around. So
yeah. And pick some tunes.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike and I, you know, we may talk philosophy on and on into the early dawn, but in our hearts and spirits, we like to play music. And Mike was out here not long ago.
Where we
might exchange some tunes. My project now is I'm building musical instruments and really kind of digging it. I got all these cool woods.
Right. Yeah, I hijacked one of Kent's dulcimers and brought it home with me after my trip to Seattle it was about a month ago or maybe a month and a half ago. But yeah, we went saw some great music and actually got to play some great music with some super talented guys. Actually, we got their CD here now at the station, the Sweets Mill Bluegrass Band. What's the full name of the band? I forget. Sweets Mill
Sweet Smell Spring Band.
It's a bunch
of guys. We're all old coots now. But when we were younger in the San Joaquin Valley, there was this bard there named Kenny Hall.
Kenny Hall.
And, Kenny Hall, he's a blind fiddler, and he's a walking encyclopedia of music that was written before 1910. And he taught us all this. He calls it old-timey music. It's sort of bluegrass. He doesn't like the word bluegrass. He likes old-timey because he plays the tunes that were written before the bluegrass thing happened.
Right.
And the first time I met him, he came into my house, and I had a mandolin there, which he wasn't packing one. And I said, here, does this work? And he played 10 hours straight. 10 hours straight, never repeated the tune.
Oh, my God.
So, see, again, that's what the human...
Yeah.
The human, we're talking human potential here.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Shaughnessy in Ireland, the people that keeps these myths. That can store this information in their brains and be able to transmit it to those willing to hear or to listen.
Right. Yeah, and it's crazy because it's still it's something that I firmly believe that we're all capable of. At least we're born capable of it. I don't know if by the time you're my age or your age, if we can pull it off anymore because of all the enculturation and conditioning and things that we go through as humans in our culture. But I think that when we're born, we all got that potential to do things beyond what most people would even consider reasonable in any means. You know, I think that we're capable of just incredible things. So.
Well, do it all, I say. You know, don't let your imagination wither on the vine.
But don't
deny your analytical capacity, too, because look what science has given us. We got these incredible space problems. The Internet is amazing, too.
Oh, man.
You might be a little bit gun-shy but sometimes, but you can look. You can go to the Internet and look to the eyes of spacecraft that are out orbiting around the sun or plunked down on the surface of Mars.
Right.
Mars is another story, but then what the Opportunity rover is picking up there is just mind-blowing.
Right, right. We'll have to do another show and we'll talk about Mars.
Yeah, there are all these little blue balls all over the place, these craters up in Mars, and there's a fellow...
Gerald.
Gerald, he got a hold of me and he said, well, we got these things out in the Four Corners area. He lives out in the Anasazi land.
Oh, man.
Four Corners area. And he sent me these little azurite, malachite spheres. And they're sitting right here about 2 feet away within reach. And they're dead ringers for these little blue balls that are all over the place by the billions.
to Anasazi land, you know, that talk about monuments and alignments. There's a lot of that going on down there too. So, boy, oh boy,
Mars is a fascinating place. I've gotten images recently from the European Space Agency.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think the UK has given us a straighter picture of what's up there.
My trust level for NASA is about as low as it's ever been. So. Anyway.
Well, see, Percival Lowell was the greatest Mars astronomer ever around.
Right, by far.
And, you know, what he observed in his lifetime had every man in the street back during his era believing that there was life on Mars. I mean, nobody ever questioned it.
Right, it was just common.
You go out and talk to some guy, oh, yeah, there's Martians. And
sure.
Then the science fiction writers got their start, H.G. Wells and...
Asimov.
Well,
Jules Verne.
They began to write these incredible stories about Mars. And so every man, the mythology and the experience of that time, under the influence of Percival Lowell, was that, there's Mars up there. I mean, there's life up on Mars.
Right.
And I don't know what happened. And then a sort of wave of Mars investigators came along and just squelched that idea.
Boy, it's amazing how amazing how often that's happened in our in our country's brief history. How many times we've had incredible advances that have been, for some reason or another, political or I don't know what the motives are, profits or money or whatever. But man, I tell you, it's really unfortunate. We've had so many great. I mean, I think of Tesla. You know, I think of Wilhelm Reich. I think of Royal Raymond Rife. You know, I thought, you know, Percival Lowell, and then the list goes on and on. And you can go back to Galileo. You know.
Yeah, what I think happened is there were certain elements that came into astronomy that were sworn almost by oath to maintain a dogma that, you know, it's the old battle between religion and science.
Well, they
sort of invaded astronomy, but they were sworn by oath to maintain whatever they found that contradicts the medieval dogma, to just put the squelch on it.
Yeah, and what do we have? We've got the Vatican running one of the most important telescopes in the country over there in Kitt Peak at Arizona University of Arizona.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of fine Jesuit scholars.
And I agree with that. I agree.
But and we owe them a lot. But you know, at the same time, they have a belief system that they want to filter everything. Well, we all do that, you know.
Right.
And so they're in the University of Arizona, they're in NASA, and Hubble are very influential, influential people. And they're still in some, you can find papers where they're still arguing the validity of Aristotle and Galileo.
Right.
So, that might smack at some level of motivated by an old belief system. Some sort of a sensory
censure or something, yeah.
But Mars, you know, I've recently gotten images from European Space Agency showing these green belts.
Oh yeah, I mean it's crazy the imagery we're seeing now. I mean, if you haven't seen it, you're not seeing it on CNN. But if you go out and look, the images are out there, and you can get to a lot of them if you go through Kent's website. But you'll see things that'll blow your mind, for sure.
Remember when we found the Mariner 9?
Yes, and how old were those images, Ken?
Well, those are in the, when were they? They're in the 60s. The
right, first late 60s, because Viking was 72.
Yeah, I think it was 67, 68.
Right. This is 37 years ago, people. 37 years ago.
Well, a couple of years ago, posted all the Mariner data up on the internet, and it blew me away. I had no idea it was so there's so much.
Well, remember, I mean, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that a lot of people saw the raw data, but didn't even get it, kind of. But what you realized was that it was compressed or something, and that it had to be expanded or something. I forget what you did with it. You did some digital work to it or something, and then bingo, all of a sudden friggin' waterfalls came out and stuff. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it's the raw data had to be stretched, what they call stretch, and there's an application specifically designed for NASA to do that. It's called NASA View. Once you run them through NASA View, these sort of pale-looking anomalous photographs of the surface of Mars taken them back to 1968. Suddenly, Mars, what they saw there, comes to life, and what we see is more of a living planet, you know, with clouds and
atmosphere.
And up in the north, along the pole areas, you see what look to be like huge rivers. Like, you go outside in the winter day and things start to thaw and the water's starting to run. That's what it looks like.
Right.
You have clouds.
Right. There's a whole nother show there. I think we'll have to do that. We'll have to talk about Mars sometime, and we'll dig into orbit and find some of that old imagery and let some people take a look at all that stuff. Because man, that is a great story, Ken. And hey, we got about 3 minutes, and then we're gonna hit it. So why don't you finish up, say something to. Finish up, and then I'll.
Well, it's sure nice to be with all you people. Maybe sometime we can have a two-way feedback deal, because I'd sure like to meet you great folks from Missouri, there's things out there that I really want to see and do.
Well, I tell you, Kent, as soon as I figure out this phone system a little bit better, we do have the capability to take calls here. It's just I'm not comfortable enough yet to do it.
Yeah.
So I'll figure that out, and the next time you're on, we'll open the phone lines with a half hour left or something, and we'll let some people call.
And you're certainly welcome to, you know, I use several forums, discussion forums. If you'll come to cyberspaceorbit.com, kind of hang around a little bit, you can email, we can just start talking about things in email or in one of the various forums, offsite forums that I'm using, or get a hold of Mike. And Mike and I sometimes spend late hours talking about things that we haven't even dipped into yet tonight.
Right. There's a lot to talk about, people, and I think that's sort of been the theme of this inaugural broadcast of this program. You know, that the universe that we live in, the world that we live in, is an incredibly interesting and an incredibly an immense, unbelievable mystery. And we're lucky to be here to be able to participate in it and do it. You know, you're in the middle of an incredible movie. You're in the middle of your own movie, and you can make it what you want. This radio program for me is something that a few months ago I said, hey, I'm gonna make a radio program, you know, and here we are. So you can do whatever you want, and the potential of us humans is really something else, and we just need to realize it and use our imaginations and go for it, man.
Well, congratulations, Mike. What a great deal you got going there. And the motto for Orbit, it goes like this: in an infinite cosmos, all dreams are true. Think about that.
In an infinite cosmos, all dreams are true. All right, that's the way to end this program, I think. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being with me. Kent Stedman, you are the man. I love you. And I'll talk to you real soon. And ladies and gentlemen, Radio Orbit, the secrets of everything tonight, talking to Kent Stedman. It was a pleasure. And we're gonna hit the road here with a song called Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits. And I hope you guys like it.
Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your soul, my friend, as the battle restarted.
Yeah.